The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. Hello, this is Derek Frost from the Triangle Radio Reading Service. For the next hour, I'll be reading to you from the Triangle Business Journal. And we start on the front page of the Triangle Business Journal with the headline for the special report, 2018 Leaders in Diversity Awards. These leaders empowered others to rise and contribute to a growing and diverse community. And in the profiles of the Leaders in Diversity, we'll start with the Lifetime Achievement Award that focuses on John Herrera, title Senior Vice President of Latino and Hispanic Affairs at Self-Help Credit Union in Durham, family, wife, Glisseria, six children, from Costa Rica, education, MS, NC State University, BS, University of Delaware. The headline, Giving Voice to an Entire Community, and this article was written by Lauren K. Onasorge. For John Herrera, Latino activist, co-founder of Latino Community Credit Union and Triangle Business Journal's 2018 Leaders in Diversity Lifetime Achievement Award winner, the message is simple. Always leave a place better than you found it. That's something my parents always taught, Herrera, a Costa Rica native, says. I'm an organizer by heart, and everywhere I go, I'm trying to build communities, bring communities together, and leave a print, he explains. For Herrera, the youngest of 12 children, it was anything but easy upbringing. Five of his brothers and sisters didn't survive past the age of five because of curable tropical diseases, he says. His father was a farm worker, far removed from the closest hospital, so by the time his six siblings made it to see a doctor, they were dead or dying, he recalls. I feel like I'm living also on their behalf. I know that there's a lot of people around the world who suffer the same dilemma, he says. I want to make sure we eliminate that kind of poverty. Herrera came to the U.S. to study at the University of Delaware in 1983. After a stint in North Carolina, graduate studies took him back to the state in 1992. It was a different state back then, he recalls. While grocery store aisles today have a diverse collection of ethnic ingredients and brands, they didn't in the North Carolina of the 90s. Salvadorians and Mexicans were here, he says. They were working in landscaping, agriculture, the service industry, but it was not an organized community. So, in 1994, Herrera launched Fiesta El Pueblo to bring people together in Chapel Hill. At that first festival event, his team prepared food for 300 farmers, and about 3,000 people showed up. That's how we knew the community is really growing, he says, noting that today the group has a presence in all 100 counties of North Carolina, integrating people from many different Spanish-speaking countries. The state got its own wake-up call when the 2000 census showed just how rapidly the minority group was growing in the state. Today they make up about 10% of North Carolina's population. But 18 years ago, there wasn't a unified system to get a bank account. Different financial institutions require different documentation, and many Latinos, some from cash-based countries, shied away, making them targets for crime. The criminal element knew it was really easy, Herrera recalls. If you want to get cash, you rob a Mexican worker on a Friday night. So he posed the idea to the top brass at Self-Help Credit Union in Durham, hoping that if they weren't on board with Latino Credit Union, a compromise might be a bilingual branch. But they stepped up. To our surprise, he says, and Latino Credit Union was founded in 2000. The business plan called for growing by 500 members per year, a number it exceeded within its first 2 months, Herrera says. That's when we knew we were in uncharted territories, he says. In addition to traditional banking functions, the credit union is on a mission to provide financial education. We work with folks who have never had a bank account, he says. Latino Community Credit Union has grown to more than 80,000 members, more than $305 million in assets, and 13 branches throughout the state, and it's not done. While it's focused on personal loans, for many, that $10,000 is a business loan, he says, and it's how he's building communities. Herrera's title is Vice President of Latino-Hispanic Affairs for Self-Help, where he's credited with helping to expand lending to Latinos from under 5% in 1999 to more than 30% in 2004. And in addition to founding El Pueblo Incorporated and being a founding board member of El Centro Latino, He is a former Eisenhower Fellow and was honored by the White House as a champion of change in 2013. Earlier this year, Time magazine named Herrera as one of the 31 people who are changing the South. John is one of those guys who does deep, meaningful social justice work, Farad Ali, vice president of the Latino Credit Union Board of Directors, says. He connects people through values, and while he's doing that, he doesn't shy away from hard conversations. Ali says Ferreira understands that, in addition to social justice, economic justice is critical in developing sustainable, growing communities. I think John is one of the pieces of the puzzle that allowed for there to be better services, financial services and human services, to the Latino community, he says. He was an important voice. And we'll also read a couple of the other profiles. The first one is on Rashek Ellis of Syngenta. Title, Internal Communications Manager, Birthplace, Washington, D.C. Family, Partner, Jeffrey Meeks. Education, B.A., Communications and New Media Technology, Southern New Hampshire University. Company description, Science and Innovative Crop Solutions. How did you contribute to your organization's diversity mission? I helped design and create the framework for our employee resource groups, which are critical to pushing Syngenta's diversity and inclusion mission. I also have brought leaders on board, putting them in situations where they can experience the importance of diversity and inclusion. My contributions have also led to Syngenta being a bit more vocal on our external social media channels about our support for greeting diverse and inclusive workforces, especially within the agriculture industry. What are some of the biggest accomplishments by you and your company in the past year in the field of diversity? Creating regional awareness within the organization. Across the organization, people are asking the questions, engaging in dialogue, and pushing for inclusive leadership. Much of this work is being done by our employee resource groups, which have been empowered to create space for safe discussion and consistent conversation on this topic of diversity and inclusion. In addition to the awareness building, we have leaders who are showing up in the right places and who are helping advance the organization along the journey of diversity and inclusion. What are the greatest challenges or obstacles in implementing a diversity policy in any organization? Some of the most significant challenges are in this notion that diversity and inclusion are all about completing a quota, having the right mix in the C-suite or through the ranks of the organization. We must realize that building a diverse workforce requires us to meet at the intersection of belonging and empowerment. We must not only create diverse and inclusive environments, but we should also ensure that all feel as though they are empowered to be their most true and authentic selves. Whom do you consider to be your mentor? My mentor is Anna Davis, head of health, safety, and environment for Syngenta. She has encouraged me to be my authentic self and has empowered me to tell my truth unapologetically. We've learned so much from each other, and she is a great ally and champion for creating diverse and inclusive work environments. Where do you see the best example of diversity advancing in the triangle? Within the tech industry, this industry has taken some initiative and creative approaches toward the advancement of diversity. Overall, I see a lot of work being done in the triangle that has pushed us further along on the journey. However, this journey requires all of us to participate in what should continually be an evolving process. What does the triangle need to do to have a vibrant atmosphere for a thriving, diverse workforce across all sectors? The triangle must continue to embrace the diversity of thought, continue to work with businesses to attract the best talent, and encourage inclusive community building. The triangle must at some point develop a diversity and inclusion master plan to tackle the challenges and opportunities related to diverse workforces across all sectors. This area must collaborate across sectors to come up with empowering solutions that will continue to foster an atmosphere of growth, which is diverse, inclusive, and where everyone feels as if they belong. What is your most rewarding volunteer experience? Mentoring a young student through the African American Male Initiative. And what is your favorite thing about living in the Triangle? As a self-proclaimed foodie, I enjoy the food culture of the Triangle. There's plenty of diversity when it comes to culinary options. And next we have Pamela Gales, Wake County Public School System. Title, Hub Program Manager, Birthplace Sanford. Family, daughter Taylor, son Stevie. Education, BA Management, American Intercontinental University. Company description, public school system. How did you contribute to your organization's diversity mission? I help plan, coordinate, and administer activities involving the historically underutilized business or hub program. I was responsible for all hub activities, including facilitating compliance with policies and procedures, hub reporting, and marketing and outreach efforts for hub participation. What are some of the biggest accomplishments by you and your company in the past year in the field of diversity? I have worked diligently to include all minority and women-owned businesses into the hub program with Wake County Public Schools. Since starting my position with WCPSS in 2014, I have increased the diversity spend to over 25% each year. Just this year, over 57% minority and women participation was achieved on a school project. I have increased participation by continuing to incorporate the five core areas of my program, which are marketing, outreach, technical assistance, utilization, and compliance. What are the greatest challenges or obstacles in implementing a diversity policy in any organization? Getting the leadership to recognize there is a need to implement a diversity policy. If there is no support from the top, then the policy won't reflect a work culture of diversity and inclusion. Whom do you consider to be your mentor? Jacqueline Boyce. She was the first person to recognize my strengths in the field of diversity, and she also helped me become the strong leader I am today. Where do you see the best example of diversity advancing in the Triangle? The best example I see of diversity advancing in the Triangle is that so many companies are embracing and implementing diversity and inclusion policies and procedures into their organizations, and therefore creating a more inclusive environment within their organizations. What does the Triangle need to do to have a vibrant atmosphere for a thriving, diverse workforce across all sectors? The Triangle needs to make sure that we are all of one accord when it comes to having a diverse workforce across all sectors. We need to make sure we have leaders of companies and organizations that make it a priority for their workforce to be diverse. They need to make sure their hiring practices and internal policies are free from any barriers that would disqualify any qualified candidates. What is your most rewarding volunteer experience? The one thing that has been the most rewarding for me in my diversity work has been my volunteer position as president of the North Carolina Minority Women Business Enterprise Coordinators Network. The network is run by a volunteer executive board, and it has given me a wonderful opportunity to grow and lead other diversity professionals. What is your favorite thing about living in the Triangle? There are so many things to do here. Living in the Triangle, you have all the big city glamour wrapped up in a small town living. We have access to anything here in the Triangle that you would in New York or California. That makes it an attractive place to live, work, and play. Now we turn to Biz, a quick glance at Triangle happenings, written by managing editor Dane Huffman. Body paint, disco lights mark Museum of Art celebration. The North Carolina Museum of Art celebrated the leadership of Larry Wheeler on September 22 with a bash that splashed across both buildings on the museum campus and included an A-list crowd and jaw-dropping touches. Wheeler brought more than just a keen sense of art when he arrived at the museum in October 1994. He energized the museum with visions of spectacular shows, including the blockbuster Rodin exhibit in 2000, and had a deft touch with donors. Indeed, his send-off party included some of the area's best-known names in the market contributing $10,000 or more, including SAS's Goodnights, the Holdings from First Citizens Bank, the News and Observer's Daniels family, Capital Broadcasting's Goodmans, and Joan Gillings, who was married to Dennis Gillings, founder of Quintiles. The event showed how Wheeler knew to make a museum fun. He ramped up a festive atmosphere that sparked interest and led to a new building, new performance stage, and a new outdoor park that replaced the youth prison. The September 22 event was a celebration of his tenure, and the party didn't disappoint. Revelers arrived in creative cocktail attire, passing by the illuminated words, "Thanks, Larry," and were greeted by actors in body paint that matched pieces in the museum's collection. In all, 675 people swarmed in to enjoy food and drink and dancing to a disco theme in the East Wing. The party was privately funded by the Museum of Art Foundation. Wheeler, who oversaw the acquisition of 1,335 works of art, retires in October. Look who's playing in the Smith Center this time. The Duke-Carolina rivalry will be renewed at the Smith Center on September 28 when the Charlotte Hornets and Boston Celtics kick off the 2018 NBA preseason. Former UNC Chapel Hill star Marvin Williams will return to the court, where he helped the Tar Heels win the 2005 NCAA title. And the Celtics have two former Duke University players in Jason Tatum and Kyrie Irving. Tatum played for the Blue Devils during the 2017 season, scoring 13 points in his sole appearance in Chapel Hill. Irving, who only played 11 games in his single season at Duke in the 2010-2011 season, will play at the Smith Center for the first time. Devontae Graham, a Broughton High School graduate who went on to play for the University of Kansas, is also on the Hornets roster. The Hornets haven't made the playoffs since 2016, but are optimistic after adding veteran Tony Parker to boost the backcourt. Hey, the ceiling is the roof, right? It's chaos out there. Wow, what a great opportunity. Better and faster was the theme September 21 when the Greater Raleigh Chamber of Commerce held its annual meeting at the Raleigh Convention Center. As Jimmy Goodman, president of Capital Broadcasting Company, told the crowd, "We can't stop growing. It's not our choice. None of us can be the last person to move to Wake County, so we can plan smart or leave it up to luck." Being smart and exploiting chaos was the theme from Speaker Jeremy Gutch, an author and consultant who amused the crowd of more than 700 by calling Raleigh Rally, but he made some great points about innovation, saying companies became geared to protecting the status quo. "We are pre-wired to do whatever led to last year's harvest," he said. But Gutch pointed out, chaos creates predictable opportunity. The key is finding overlooked opportunities. Success now requires companies to be insatiable, curious, and willing to destroy what worked in the past. Rethink what people actually want and accelerate that, he said. Rock star in the world of marketing remembered. When longtime Triangle ad man Howard Rocket took over the GlaxoSmithKline account, then known as Glaxo, in the mid-1990s, the pharmaceutical industry was under attack from government officials and the public for drug costs. But he put together a new slogan for the company, "On the Brink of Discovery." The tagline helped shift the perception of drug companies, according to his son, Mark Rocket. Howard Rocket died September 19 in Pinehurst. He leaves behind a legacy that includes a founding contribution to McKinney, Silver, and Rocket, now known as McKinney, and RBW Advertising. In 2000, he was inducted into the North Carolina Media and Journalism Hall of Fame. Big deal has execs enthused and Raleigh implications. A month after completing its buy of New York-based Ipreo, a financial technology firm growing in downtown Raleigh, executives at IHS Markit are talking up the deal. Lance Ugla, CEO of IHS Markit, said on a recent earnings call that the company is very pleased with the early days of the integration and well on its way to meeting the run rate cost synergies estimate of $20 million by the end of 2019. "Teams are working together extremely well and with a lot of excitement around what we can achieve," he said. Ipreo, whose buyout closed August 2nd, has already contributed about $25 million in revenue, Chief Financial Officer Todd Hyatt told investors. Ipreo announced earlier this year that it would be adding 250 jobs to its Raleigh operations. Executives said last month that the plan doesn't change with the buyout. NC Camps didn't want to say ahoy there to Florence. Two of North Carolina's best-known camps are scrambling to recover from Hurricane Florence. Camp Seagull and Camp Seafarer, located half an hour from New Bern, suffered substantial damage from the storm. Piers at both sites were damaged, and Seagull in particular suffered waterfront erosion, downed trees, and sewer damage. Raleigh's Bob and Amanda Ramsher, leading this year's annual fundraising campaign, have asked donors to increase their gifts by 20%. Camp Seagull was founded by Wyatt and Lil Taylor in 1948 and Seafarer in 1961, but the camps, which draw hundreds of children, expect to be fully operational for the 2019 season, and again, greeting kids with an enthusiastic ahoy there. Now we turn to On Tech and Transportation, written by Lauren Onasorge. RDU advances runway plan, eyes China flight. Raleigh-Durham International Airport is a step closer to getting its new international runway. An 11,500-foot strip of pavement, officials say, could someday launch a nonstop flight to China. At its September meeting, the RDU Airport Authority approved a $3.4 million schematic design contract to Florida consultant Reynolds Smith & Hills. If all goes as expected, those drawings for a new runway could be presented next June. Plans to secure a China flight are intensifying. A group of RDU officials, including Christy Van Auken, Vice President of Communications and Community Affairs, recently returned from a trip to China where they pitched the triangle to airline and airport officials. "We spoke with 14 airlines," says Van Auken. "We have no announcements to bring home, but that's not the goal. It's really to build relationships and to educate and to learn about airlines, their network strategies, and to see if there's a good match to the community." She says RDU spoke with all four of China's major airlines. "We're at the very early part of the process, but there was some interest," Van Auken says. "It won't happen without the runway. The current runway is called 5L-23R. At 10,000 feet, it's the main strip for RDU's transcontinental and transatlantic flights, but at 34 years old, it's nearing its end of life and will be decommissioned when the new runway opens for traffic. CSX targeted in Hurricane Florence lawsuit. Five Lumberton property owners have filed what they hope will be a class action lawsuit against CSX, alleging their properties flooded after Hurricane Florence and that the Jacksonville, Florida-based train giant is to blame. The lead plaintiffs, Jimmy Edwards, Robert Hunt, Dolores Hunt, Clifford McKellar Jr., and Emma McKellar, recount how the flooding damaged their community. "Numerous homes and vehicles in South Lumberton and West Lumberton were damaged or destroyed by water which poured through a gap in city levees," the suit states. "This gap was created by a railway underpass owned by CSX Corporation." According to the September 24 suit, CSX was aware that the underpass was a point of vulnerability for major flooding in Lumberton and ignored reports warning of the need for a permanent floodgate. The complaint claims CSX even refused officials' request September 10 to build a sandbag berm. Governor Roy Cooper issued an emergency order September 14 approving a sandbag berm's construction. The levee berm still broke as the waters rose. Attorneys Daniel Bryson, Scott Harris, and Matthew Lee of Whitfield, Bryson, and Mason in Raleigh filed the suit. In a statement September 24, a CSX spokeswoman said that while CSX does not comment on matters before the court, it is important to point out that Hurricane Florence was an extraordinary storm that brought record flooding and left many communities throughout the region devastated, including Lumberton. Insurance tech firm picks Chapel Hill for HQ. An insurance technology startup has picked downtown Chapel Hill for its new headquarters. Rain, spelled R-E-I-N, has moved into half of the top floor at the Central, which was previously known as 137 East Franklin. CEO Christopher Dean says the company considered other locations in the Triangle before picking the new spot. "We put it to a vote," he says. "The staff, they really liked the place. It was not overly corporate and had lots of energy. We as a group thought Franklin Street would be a great place for a technology company." Dean, the former CEO of Raleigh-based drone developer Precision Hawk, now led by Michael Chasen, joined Rain in 2017 with the goal of combining his passion for drones with opportunities in other disruptive industries, he says. "I thought the insurance industry would be a great place to build a startup," he says. "I like building things. I'm a builder, and I had confidence we could do something special in this space." And the company is hiring, particularly in sales and engineering. "We probably have about five positions," Dean says. The company has developed a data-driven platform designed to create new insurance products. Rain recently launched its first digital product, DroneInsurance.com, which offers tailored insurance for commercial drone pilots. And it announced it had raised $7.3 million earlier this year from investors such as Liberty Mutual Strategic Ventures and Kipling Central. Walk Me, now ready for a big run in Raleigh after Funder. A $40 million funder will accelerate a San Francisco-based software firm's growth in Raleigh. That's according to Rafael Swery, co-founder and president of Walk Me, which picked Raleigh for its regional headquarters in 2016. It looks like we're going to continue growing as a company, and specifically with Raleigh, we are now more aggressive than we were before, Swery says. The entire company is growing. Rising water lifts all boats. Over the past 2 years, the firm has found great talent in the Triangle. There is quite a pipeline, he says. Right now, the company has 65 Raleigh employees, with plans to be at 80 by the end of the year. In 2019, Swery expects the count to grow by 50 to 100%. He says WalkMe, which recently moved into new space downtown, may find itself on another real estate search in Raleigh to accommodate the growing headcount. The funding round, led by Insight Venture Partners with participation from Mangrove Capital Partners, increases WalkMe's total haul to $207.5 million to date. And finally, in a section called He Said It, the quote, "The concern about a trade war with China is spooking some people, but at this point, I wouldn't say I've seen that ripple all the way through into spending, so it still feels pretty good." That's Jim Whitehurst, Red Hat CEO, to analysts after reporting $822.7 million in second quarter revenue and just missing the $830 million predicted by Thomson Reuters. Now in the Triangle Business Journal, we turn to the On Real Estate pages with written by Ben Graham. The first headline, "With new building, Raleigh firm plans to add 100 jobs. A fast-growing employee wellness company in Raleigh has plans to expand its current campus on Highwoods Boulevard and is closing on another office building across the street. When construction is complete, Workplace Options CEO Dean Debnam estimates the expansion will result in another 100 new jobs for the company's Raleigh operations. The new building will rise 3 stories and total just under 70,000 square feet at 3020 Highwood Boulevard, replacing a 1970s-era single-story structure that has served as the home of the company's IT department, according to plans filed with the city. It's an older building, Debnam says. It wasn't suitable to remodel, so we decided to tear it down. He estimates construction will cost at least $10 million, with another $2 million to $3 million being spent on improving the interior. The new building is being constructed on the footprint of the old, allowing some of the IT infrastructure to remain intact, including the fiber optic network that had been previously installed. The expansion plans come in the midst of a rapid growth spurt for the company, which has offices across the globe. Jobs are also being added in Paris, Toronto, and Bengaluru, India. At the same time, Debnam has been beefing up his real estate portfolio using holding companies that are separate from Workplace Options. Debnam's various property holdings total 290,000 square feet of office space around Highwoods Boulevard, including the proposed office building and another building he will close on in the near future. Last year, Debnam spent $4.45 million on a 39,000 square foot building on Poplarwood Court, a deal that preceded another 2-building acquisition on the street in 2015 for a combined $7.5 million. Some, but not all, of Debnam's office portfolio is used to house Workplace Options. Workplace Options' current headcount is about 700 globally, with 400 of those employees working in Raleigh. Revenue is on track to approach $100 million in 2019, Debnam says, about double the revenue of 5 years ago. "We focus on what we do," he says. "That's been a lot of consolidation. There's been a lot of consolidation in the industry, and we are leading on that." SC firm buys Raleigh Shopping Center a decade after failed project. A North Raleigh shopping center has traded hands for $15.3 million, giving investors a $2 million return on a 5-year investment. The deal brings a South Carolina firm back into the Triangle real estate market a decade after a failed project in Wendell. DNA Partners of New York sold the 86,000-square-foot Greystone Village to real estate investment firm Burroughs & Chapin. The Charleston, South Carolina-based firm was the original developer behind the sprawling Wendell Farms development that went belly up in 2008 after a loan default. Today, the company's holdings are mostly along the Carolina coast, according to its website, including shopping centers in places such as Wilmington, where it owns the 50,000-square-foot Lumina Station. Greystone Village looks to be the company's first venture back in the Triangle. The complex, built in 1986, is completely leased. Tenants include Gonza, Tacos and Tequila, and Kai Japanese Restaurant. The sale also included three out parcels. Alex Quarrier, Mark Osborne, and John Lineberger of Berkeley Capital Investors represented the sellers. Damage estimates show mounting losses from Florence. While many of the communities in the path of Hurricane Florence are only beginning to tally up the specific costs of the storm's destruction, preliminary estimates of the overall damage paint a grave picture. By one calculation, total property damage across the Carolinas and Virginia is expected to fall between $19 billion and $28.5 billion. According to another, more than 2,600 commercial buildings were submerged by at least a foot of water in the wake of the storm, with more damage expected as floodwaters continue to linger over the coast. More than 600,000 homes have seen some kind of damage from wind or water. Florence is definitely a major flood loss event, David Smith, CoreLogic Senior Director of Model Development, said in an email. His firm has used modeling and granular property data to estimate commercial and residential real estate damage across the storm's path, finding that losses to insured property could reach as high as $10 billion, while uninsured losses could peak at $18.5 billion. Damage to uninsured homes is outpacing losses to insured property because many of the homes affected by Florence are outside of the federal government's special flood hazard areas in which homeowners with mortgages are required to have flood insurance. The numbers aren't surprising to Jay Bass, claims manager at Trisure, an insurance brokerage firm in Raleigh. Uninsured claims tend to exceed insured damages in major flooding events because insurance isn't always required, he says. You've got an awful lot of flood damage claims, Bass says. When you look at New Bern, it's just monumental. The city has already estimated residential damage of $74.5 million and commercial damage of $25.6 million, according to a tweet from the city. Apartments in downtown Raleigh hit pricey sales mark. An apartment developer has sold a luxury complex built just a few blocks north of the state capitol for $50.75 million, a price tag that puts the transaction on par with other recent luxury sales in the Triangle's urban centers. The sale price for the Elan City Center Apartments, built by South Carolina-based Graystar, breaks down to $238,263 per unit. The only other similar transaction in recent months was downtown Durham's Bull House Apartments, which traded hands in June for $250,000 per unit. The buyer of the five-story complex is Principal Real Estate Investors, an Iowa real estate investment firm that has been active in the Triangle recently. Last year, the company sold four office buildings at Imperial Center for just under $50 million before buying a new industrial facility in Research Triangle Park later that year, paying $27 million for the Power Secure Industrial Campus. The sale shows strong investor appetite for higher-end apartment complexes and continues a streak of large multifamily acquisitions across the region. Fast-growing retailer to open store at Crossroads Plaza. While many clothing retailers have struggled to keep pace in the age of online sales, a Wisconsin-based apparel chain that sells outdoor and work-oriented clothing has been gobbling up shopfront space across the country and has now set its sights on Cary. Duluth Trading Company plans to open a new location in 11,000 square feet at the Crossroads Plaza Shopping Center, just south of the intersection of I-40 and I-440, according to the company. Duluth Trading Company officials declined to comment on specifics of the decision, other than to say the opening is scheduled for the fourth quarter of the 2018 fiscal year. Job postings state that employment begins October 9. The location is part of a wave of new store openings by the company, which produces a wide variety of clothing and gear from button-down shirts to tool bags. 10 more are planned for the coming months from Arlington, Texas to Anchorage, Alaska, and the company said it wants to have 100 stores in the next 5 years. The company has gained a following for its comical advertisements and product names such as Buck Naked Underwear. In Cary, the company will be filling space left vacant by Tilly's, a youth clothing retailer. The 681,000 square foot shopping complex was just 2.7% vacant at the end of the second quarter, according to Triangle Business Journal's Space publication. John Staley of JLL represented the landlord in the lease. Now we turn to On Business Trends, written by Harrison Miller. Parents fret as kids eye screens. A new study from Raleigh-based Republic Wireless provides insight into how much tech overuse and screen consumption has negatively impacted family life. According to the study, the average household has 3.7 tech devices and 2.4 screens per person. Not only do kids now have an abundance of screens at home, tech time has become almost a full-time job for children. Kids 6 to 11 years old are spending roughly 33 hours in front of screens per week. Teens are using tech even more, with 45 hours of their week dedicated to screen time. This has caused a struggle for parents to find a balance between screen and family time. Of the parents who were surveyed, 76 believe too much technology is a bad thing at home. It's also caused problems for families, with 59% of parents stating that screen time interrupts quality time with their children. Screen overload often leads to conflict at home. A third of the parents surveyed frequently argue with their kids about screen time, and 26% argue about how much should be allowed. Over half of all parents, 52%, suffer backlash and frustration when telling kids to turn off their screens. Because of this dependence on screens, parents are changing the way they are punishing their children. Nearly 80% of parents stated their kids lose screen time due to misbehavior or not taking care of responsibilities. And half of parents say their children can earn screen time back after taking care of those household duties. BioAgilytics to expand its campus in Durham. BioAgilytics, the Durham-based provider of contract bioanalytical testing services, plans to continue its aggressive growth in the Triangle by expanding the company's headquarters. The company will be adding an additional 21,173 square foot building directly adjacent to its existing facility in Durham, bringing the total campus to 69,000 square feet. Just under half of the new facility will be dedicated to lab space. Across the board, industry demand for bioanalysis supporting large molecular drug development is on the rise, said Jim Dayton, president and CEO of BioAgilytics. The expansion will ensure we can continue to meet sponsor demands efficiently and effectively to deliver the timely and robust results they need. Feds fund $3.5 million for drug firm's yellow fever drug. A Durham pharmaceutical company has received $3.5 million from a federal agency to support clinical trials for a drug to treat people with yellow fever. For BioCryst Pharmaceuticals, the latest funds from the National Institute of Allergy and Infectious Diseases, NIAID, for Galidesivir brings development contract funding to a total of $43 million. BioCryst saw success during its Phase 1 trials. Healthy patients tolerated the drug and found it to be safe. In animal studies, Galidesivir showed benefits against several viruses, including Ebola, yellow fever, and Zika. Severe cases of yellow fever led to a fatal heart, liver, and kidney condition. The disease is particularly serious in tropical areas of Africa and Central America and South America, responsible for 170,000 severe cases and up to 60,000 deaths annually, according to the World Health Organization. Currently, there is no approved treatment for the disease. Brazil, in particular, faces serious issues with the disease. Seasonal outbreaks have put more than 35 million people at risk, and the Brazilian Ministry of Health has confirmed 2,043 cases and 676 deaths from yellow fever since December 2016. And now we turn to the Viewpoint page to read the editor's notebook written by Sugata Mukherjee, editor of the Triangle Business Journal. The headline, Businesses Can Learn from Tiger's Mental Strength. Some 15 years ago, Ray Shaw, the late chairman and founder of American City Business Journals, told a group of editors why he liked hiring people who have played competitive sports. I don't remember the exact quote, but Shaw emphasized that playing sports competitively hardens an individual's desire to win and to continuously work on getting better. And despite the fact that many people said last year that he is done and will never win another professional golf event, Tiger Woods proved them wrong. Woods knew he could get his game back if he worked hard, maybe harder than anyone, and was prepared mentally. For Woods, many of the problems over the past 10 years were self-inflicted, but he also had 4 back surgeries, and his body remarkably found a way to get back in the game. Many doctors specializing in spinal fusion surgery stated there was much more going on with Woods than just physical rehab to strengthen his glutes and internal and external obliques. They unanimously talked about his mental state, resolute, determined, and confident. In business, losing a contract or a high-performing employee is part of the routine. But managers who display the skills of staying true to the company's mission and repeatedly stress the company's most effective weapon, its superior product and services, are the ones who win in the end. Woods' mental strength and his relentless desire to win is a phenomenon. To compare those strengths to an average person may seem nonsensical. But at the same time, Woods managed to exhibit the various elements of a successful person. To me, those elements can be replicated in the workforce and in personal life. Whether it's a CEO, a husband, or a girlfriend, we have encountered various degrees of adversity in our lives. Some have come early in our careers, while for others, stressful things are happening at work or in their personal lives right now. Woods showed us that things can and will get better. If we have the mental toughness and the will to excel in whatever we do with hard work. To me, that was the indelible lesson on September 23 when he lifted his 80th PGA trophy. Maybe that's why he is adored, envied, and respected by millions across the world. Sure seemed to me like it was about more than just golf. Now we turn to the executive voice that focuses on Jeff Mann. A closer look, his name, Jeff Mann, job title, President and CEO, Education, BS, Business Management, UNC Wilmington, MBA, Wake Forest University, family, wife Susan, daughter Avery, 11, son Evan, 8, first job, tennis coach. The headline, Making the Case for Mass Transit. And this Q&A column was written by Lauren Onosorge. Jeff Mann, the president and CEO of Go Triangle, the region's transportation authority, has a high-pressure job. Faced with multiple unexpected funding cuts, he's still tasked with pushing what could one day be the region's biggest new transit investment forward, the Durham-Orange Light Rail Transit Line. And that's just one of the challenges his team faces in the next few years. As the Triangle region grows, so does its traffic. And Mann must act as part lobbyist and part executive, pushing for solutions to bottlenecks and commuting standstills on the horizon. What's the most exciting transit trend you've seen this year? The Youth GoPass program is off to a great start, with over 2,000 passes already issued. We expect strong demand to continue. Under the program, youths between the ages of 13 and 18 can now ride free throughout the Triangle. What's the biggest challenge now for transit in the Triangle? The need to progress multiple major projects on a similar timeline. In addition to the Durham-Orange Light Rail Transit Project, the county transit plans also include almost 30 miles of bus rapid transit BRT service along 5 corridors, 4 in Wake County and 1 in Orange County, and a new 37-mile commuter rail line in Durham and Wake counties with possible extension to the east and west. Commuter rail service between Raleigh and Wake Forest is also being planned. In total, we anticipate almost $5 billion in transit investment over the next 10 years in the Triangle. Why is the Durham-Orange Light Rail Project critical for our region? The Light Rail T Project links downtown Durham, 3 major universities, NC Central, Duke, and UNC Chapel Hill, 3 major healthcare facilities, Duke, UNC Healthcare, and the Durham VA, and 3 of the top 10 employers in the state, all along the nearly 18-mile corridor. Given the density of employment centers and other trip generators along the line, we believe light rail is the right technology. With the continued rapid growth in the Triangle, the line is a critical component to maintaining our mobility and quality of life. What's the biggest misconception about light rail? That it doesn't work. There are many examples of successful light rail projects throughout the country, and in fact many, if not most, systems have been expanded, indicating a desire for more service, not less. What's something that might surprise people about Go Triangle? We are a relatively new agency and one of only a few regional agencies statewide. Go Triangle began van pool operations in 1991 and fixed route bus service in 1993. Today, we provide almost 7,000 average weekday trips and serve 26 routes throughout the Triangle. Do you have any mentors? If so, who are they? Ron Tober, former CEO of Charlotte Area Transit. Fill in the blank. When it comes to transit, 2019 will be a landmark year for transit in the Triangle. During 2019, we anticipate reaching a federal full funding grant agreement for the light rail project and a number of the key Wake County projects, including one or more bus rapid transit corridors and commuter rail, are anticipated to enter into the federal funding pipeline. We're excited to help move these key transit investments forward. What's been your biggest professional victory so far? Having built a talented and strong team at Go Triangle over the past 3 years? If you weren't leading Go Triangle, what career do you see yourself having? If I were not at Go Triangle, I would still be involved in the transit and rail industry. What's your biggest stress management advice? I'm probably not the best model to follow, but for me it's spending time with my family, exercise, tennis, water sports, and maintaining interests outside of work. Work responsibilities can consume you if you let them, so don't. How is the shared economy changing transportation? We view shared ride services as a potential tool for better first or last mile connectivity. In many cases, the first and last mile of a transit trip present the biggest challenge. Our partnership with Uber provides an example of how share ride services can be part of the solution. Where do you see Triangle's transit situation in 10 years? If we're successful, by 2028, the Triangle will enjoy the mobility and economic benefits from a tripling of frequent bus service in Wake County, almost 30 miles of new BRT service in Wake and Orange counties, the 17.7-mile light rail project, and commuter rail service between Wake and Durham counties with potential extension. When combined, these investments are certainly a game changer. If the Triangle were to win Apple and or Amazon, what are some ways Go Triangle might mitigate the inevitable traffic influx? Projects included in the Durham, Orange, and Wake County transit plans, including light rail, commuter rail, and BRT, will provide a new level of mobility for the Triangle. These projects are essential to maintaining the excellent quality of life that we enjoy. Historically, we have underinvested in transit, but that is changing thanks to voter-approved dedicated funding in all three counties. It's an exciting time for transit in the Triangle. Where's your go-to spot for business lunch? Tuscan Blue, downtown Raleigh. Where's your favorite family vacation spot? Carolina Beach. And what was the last book you read? Outliers by Malcolm Gladwell. Now we turn to some general news. Millions at stake for Kerry as hotel works through bankruptcy. This article is written by Lauren Onasorge. The parent company behind Kerry's Maiton Inn claims the hotel is staying open despite filing for Chapter 11 bankruptcy last week. But public records show that if Memento Mori's reorganization plan fails, taxpayers could be on the hook. The Maiton Inn opened in 2015 as the town fronted the company $2.6 million in loans to construct a hotel in the downtown area as part of the town's economic development strategy. About $1.4 million of the loan amount was to be borrowed from the Department of Housing and Urban Development for community redevelopment, an amount that is listed as a claim to the town of Kerry in bankruptcy filings filed by Memento Mori in federal court. The value of collateral supporting that claim, according to the bankruptcy filing, is listed as $17.4 million. The assessed value of the inn is $8.1 million, according to Wake County records. The town of Kerry declined to answer specific questions on the loan September 24th. It is not clear, other than the hotel, what else was used as part of loan collateral. The South Academy Street Hotel is owned by Memento Mori, according to Wake County records. It was transferred to that entity earlier this month from Maiton Landlord LLC. Both companies are owned by Deanna and Colin Crossman. We don't want to in any way prejudice or give the appearance of prejudicing the process that's underway, Kerry spokeswoman Susan Moran said in an email. What I will say is that, no, the Maiden was not in compliance with the development agreement with the town of the bankruptcy filing. In an email, Deanna Crossman said that of its two loans with the town, we are current on one but not the other. The attorneys on both sides have advocated for restraint in speaking publicly as this process gets started. All sides reached an agreement before a bankruptcy hearing September 24. So that's a great start, and we are all hopeful to work through this process amicably, she added. According to town documents, annual payments of $80,000 were to be remitted to the town, but HUD notes in its document that Kerry is ultimately responsible for those dollars, not the hotel. TransEnterix buys Israeli tech firm for $12.4 million. TransEnterix has made a $12.4 million bet on an Israel technology company that executives plan to use to boost its FDA-approved surgical robot, Senhance. This week, the Morrisville firm announced it has acquired substantially all of the assets of Medical Surgery Technologies, including its Israel-based research and development center. The acquisition was financed with a combination of cash and stock delivered in separate tranches. As of the closing of the transaction, MST received $5.8 million and 3.15 million shares of TransEnterix common stock, approximately 1.5% of the company's outstanding stock. A second $6.6 million sum will be paid out as cash or stock within the next year per TransEnterix discretion. MST's core technology is a software-based image analytics information platform that uses visualization, scene recognition, artificial intelligence, machine learning, and data analytics to provide real-time image-based feedback during surgical procedures. The company's technological goals were designed to empower and automate surgeries with a specific focus on medical robots and computer-assisted surgeries. Anthony Fernando, TransEnterix's chief operating officer, says the acquisition was part of a larger strategy to acquire necessary technologies to augment their system. We have a very clear technology roadmap we're trying to pursue. We take it bite size. What can we develop and how can we develop, he says. This happened to be something that we've been thinking about, and the opportunity presented itself. Panthers valued at $2.3 billion, 21st in the NFL. The Carolina Panthers changed owners last summer, but the value of the team remains unchanged, according to annual rankings from Forbes magazine. For the second year in a row, Carolina is valued at $2.3 billion, 21st among the 32 pro football teams. David Tepper paid $2.275 billion for the Panthers in July, buying the team from founder Jerry Richardson. The NFL awarded Richardson an expansion team in 1993 for $200 million. According to Forbes, the 2% league-wide increase in values this year is the smallest since 2011. The Dallas Cowboys team is the most valuable at $5 billion. Philadelphia-based law firm acquires NC's Smith Moore. Fox Rothschild, which has been looking to enter the Southeast region, has made its largest acquisition in 130-lawyer Smith Moore Leatherwood of Greensboro. As of November 1, Fox will add offices in Raleigh, Charlotte, Greensboro, and Wilmington. Fox chairman Mark Sillo says Smith Moore was sort of in no man's land when it comes to law firm size. They were not large or small, and they became susceptible to poaching from regional and large firms in their markets. Smith Moore managing partner Julie Earp says the merger will provide a deeper bench, a broader geography, and better technology. Growing costs and technology compelled Smith Moore Leatherwood to seek a suitor with the same values and a similar history. And with our remaining minutes, we'll read as much as we can of this last story. Struggling firm shifts HQ from Charlotte to Ohio, written by John Downey. Babcock & Wilcox Enterprises Incorporated is shifting its headquarters from Charlotte to Ohio, but the company says there will be no change, at least for now, in the roughly 90 positions at its office in the Queen City. Spokesman Ryan Cornell says that some top corporate functions remain in Charlotte, including General Counsel Andre Hall, and the company's key legal functions are there. The current employee base will remain. B&W's headquarters will be in Barberton, Ohio, where the company has 700 employees and several executives at its largest operation. CEO Leslie Cass was in B&W's Barberton office before she took over as CEO in February and has remained there since. But Barberton will not remain the headquarters for long. B&W also announced that it has agreed to a 15-year lease for new facilities in nearby Akron, Ohio. While the local operations will remain in Charlotte, they will move next year from their current location at 13024 Ballantyne Corporate Place. Cornell says the company is negotiating for a smaller space as the current location is too large for B&W's current needs, he says. B&W has been cutting costs for more than a year after announcing significant losses in its renewable segment. Six waste-to-energy projects in Europe have been designated as loss contracts as construction failures push the cost to build them higher than what the company will make from them. The company has been troubled since the surprise announcement last year that the segment, once touted as B&W's future, was responsible for huge losses in 2016. That announcement led to shareholder suits, an SEC investigation, and the ouster of CEO Jim Furland. The company has announced a series of layoffs, subsidiary sell-offs, and other cost-cutting measures in an effort to repair the damage. And actually, we have just enough time for a by-the-number section, $7.3 million. The total annual mean compensation of the 50 highest-paid occupations in the Triangle area. That's up from the $6.9 million total the year prior. And 146,334, the average mean annual wage of the 50 highest-paid occupations in the Triangle area. And we'll go ahead and stop there, as we've actually run out of time for today's episode of the Triangle Business Journal. Be sure to listen at the same time next week. We hope you've enjoyed it. I'm Derek Frost, reading for the Triangle Radio Reading Service. The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. The broadcast is readily available as a podcast after the broadcast at our website, triangleReadingService.org. So long until next time, and if you have any comments or questions, please give us a call at 919-832-5138.